pendant. The reporter wrote something to the effect of, the dealers had a sophisticated operation which included a drive-through window through which buyers could purchase drugs. They had it dead wrong, of course. Our sophisticated operation was just me selling Chad weed out the window because I was too lazy to get up from my video game and meet him outside. It might have been an exaggeration, but that article made my street cred skyrocket. I wasn't just a dope boy. I was part of a sophisticated drug ring. What member of a drug ring lives at his home where he isn't respected? What head of a drug ring lets his father put his hands on him? What head of a drug ring bothers going to high school? Not this one. Nope. You couldn't tell me I wasn't a real nigga in them Monk's Corner streets. And I was. A real stupid nigga. One who couldn't see that his choices were leading him further and further down a dead-end path. The power of God. I'm not proud about much from that time in my life, but one thing I can say I never did was ask God to look the other way when it came to my sins. I've always believed God gives us the freedom of choice when it comes to our actions. We can choose to submit to the God in us, which is our higher selves, or we can choose to submit to the devil in us, which is our lower selves. Future once rapped, "Fuck what you heard, God blessing all the trap niggas." I love Future, but I have to say he got that one wrong. Fuck what you heard. God is not blessing none of you trap niggas. Why would God bless you for ruining the community? You really think pumping poison to the people is worth you being blessed? Man, God is sending each and every one of you trap niggas prayers to his spam folder. He don't even receive those emails. Nevertheless, trap niggas always seem to think God is going to co-sign their BS. I remember my friend Zeke called me from jail one time and said, "Man, do that thing you be doing for me." I asked him what he was talking about. "That thing you be doing when you talking to God." "You mean praying?" I asked. "Yeah, do that for me if you can." I couldn't believe Zeke didn't even know how to pray. In this case, I did pray for him because Zeke was my guy, but I also told him God had nothing to do with this situation. What he really needed was a lawyer and bail. I had another homeboy who told me about a time he was trafficking guns from South Carolina to New Jersey. While he was driving through Virginia, he found himself on one of those dark backcountry roads. If you have ever made that road trip, you know Virginia has some scary back roads where you can see the mountains and it feels like Bigfoot is going to jump out in front of your car at any moment. Well, my boy didn't see Bigfoot, but he did see something much scarier. A state trooper pull up behind him. Ever been driving a car full of illegal guns while smoking weed and the police get behind you? No? Well, it creates optimum paranoia. You know once the cop hits those blue lights, pulls you over, and asks to search the vehicle, it's a wrap. My friend is a pastor's kid, the irony, right? But his reaction to that cop getting behind him was to pull out his gun and cock it. When I asked him why, he explained he knew he had to kill the cop in order to get away. "Nigga, what?" I asked. But he was dead serious. He wasn't going to prison. My boy told me that after he pulled his gun, he said a prayer to God. Seconds later, the cop hit his lights. Miraculously, instead of pulling him over, the cop just passed him and sped off to whatever emergency he was responding to. Here's the thing. My boy told that story as a testimony to God's power. In his twisted mind, God answered his prayer and made the cop drive past him. When he told me that, I looked him dead in his eye and said, "Man, if you don't shut your dumb ass up, God wasn't looking out for you. He was looking out for the cop." My boy probably got confused because he thought he was communicating with God when he was really chopping it up with the devil. That's an easy mistake to make because the devil is the one who makes the most noise. God doesn't make a big fuss. If anything, he damn near whispers. You either listen or you don't. Everything good that happens to you is because of God. Everything bad that happens to you is on you because you made the choice not to recognize the power of God in you. It was your choice. That's why I hate when people say they found God. Man, God was never lost. You were. There was never a missing persons report out for our Creator. Like father, like son. My relationship with God might have remained rock solid, but my relationship with my pops was crumbling. His warnings were clear, but I wasn't listening. One of the reasons was because he wasn't exactly following a straight and narrow path either. For starters, his cheating on my mother had been getting more flagrant. Eventually, it would come out that he'd had a second family on the side, but at the time, all I knew was that things were really bad between my parents. My father had always been my authority, and I listened to his guidance to this day. Still, seeing him hurt my mother weakened his stature in my eyes. If you're trying to get a point across to a knucklehead teenage boy, you've got to show and prove by actions and deeds. Your example is what gets through to a teenager, not words. Unfortunately, my father's example was almost completely contradicted everything he had been telling me. He'd tell me not to sell coke because I'd end up in jail, but he was out there moving it himself. He'd tell me don't hang out with street dudes, but he was one of the biggest street dudes in the area. It's no wonder my attitude toward him became whatever, man. Our issues came to a head one day after the cops pulled my father over in Kitfield and found a little coke in his car. They must have decided he was some sort of kingpin because they didn't show up in my mother's house with a search warrant. I happened to be home and told my mother she didn't have to sign the warrant. While I was trying to calm her down, the cops started shouting they were going to come back later and kick down the door. Despite my protest, she caved and let them in. The reason I didn't want those cops inside was because I happened to have a vial of crack on me. When the cops started banging on the door, I stuffed it in the pocket of a coat that was hanging in my closet. Once the cops were inside, they started tearing through the entire house, including the closet. When they pulled out the coat, I figured I was a goner. But unbeknownst to me, the pocket had a hole in it, and the vial had fallen in the jacket lining. When in their rush, the cops somehow missed it. I breathed a silent sigh of relief. My reprise was short-lived. Inside one of our trash cans, the cops found a little plastic lunch bag I'd used to carry the crack before I'd put it in the vial. There weren't even any rocks left in the bag, just some residual dust. That was enough for the cops, though. They weren't about to leave the house without an arrest. My father evidently didn't have anything stashed there, so back to Berkeley County Jail I went. Guess who was sitting in the cell when I got there? Yep, my pops. Now, when they brought me in, did he ask what happened or are you all right? Nope. The first and only thing he said was, listen, boy, do not say nothing all weekend. Not a word. It was a Friday, and for the next 3 days, we just stared at each other. No one uttered a single word. I later found out he insisted on silence because he was convinced our cell was bugged. When Monday came, they had to let us both out, since between us, they'd found less than a gram of coke. Cowboy and son weren't kingpins after all. Outside the jailhouse, we didn't have an emotional embrace or a heart-to-heart talk. Instead, we started bickering over whose fault it was that we'd been busted. You're paying for your own lawyer this time, my father scolded me. What? I shot back. I only got caught because they had a search warrant for you. Yeah, he replied, but you shouldn't have had anything in the house anyway. This is on you. That's what our relationship had deteriorated to. A father and his teenage son arguing over whose fault it was that they'd both been arrested on the same day. Pick your pee. Even though our weekend in jail represented the height of dysfunction, I still give my father a lot of the credit for helping me get out of the hole I dug for myself as a young man. Given some of the situations that I've gotten myself into, that might seem like a surprise. And it's true, at the time, my father felt like one of my biggest enemies. He screamed on me, he threatened me, he whooped my ass more than one time. The one thing he never did, however, was give up on me. No matter how many times he swore he wouldn't bail me out again, the next time I got locked up, he'd be there with the money. No matter how many times he called me out or even tried to knock me out, once the emotions had cooled, he would be there by my side, pushing me to make something out of myself. It's not easy to stand in front of your son after the two of you have spent the weekend in jail and say, boy, you need to get your life together. But my father did it. No matter how messy his own affairs were, he'd look me dead in the eye and say, you need to do better. Don't do what I do, do what I say. My father probably didn't know William Jennings Bryan from Will.i.am, but he sure as hell understood the concept of destiny is not a matter of chance, it is a matter of choice. Every lecture, every threat, and every pep talk was based around the simple principle that life wasn't just happening to me. I wasn't being pulled along by some invisible force that I had no control over. No one forced me to sip a 40 at recess. No one told me to punch that kid in the cafeteria or to smack the other kid with a lock. No one made me walk up on that Jeep. Just as no one forced me to sell weed to Chad or start hanging with the dope boys at Jarrell's. Each and every one of those situations resulted from a choice that I made. He beat that concept into my head, figuratively and literally, until I finally came to understand it as fact. Be miserable or motivate yourself. Whatever has to be done, it's always your choice. Wayne Dyer. Today, I've taken that concept and turned it into a maxim I call PYP. Pick your poison, procrastination, or passion. It reflects my belief that we have three basic choices in how we approach our lives. We can pick our poison, which is doing the dumb shit that might make us a little bit of money or temporarily feel like a big shot, but in the long run will destroy our lives. The devil is always pushing the poison on us. For me, the poison was selling drugs. For others, it could be doing drugs. It could be gambling, chasing money, or constant cheating. There are a lot of poisons to pick from out there. We can pick our procrastinations, which are those choices that aren't as obviously negative as our poisons, but still don't take us where we need to go. When I was acting crazy in school, drinking 40s and yelling good laugh, that was a form of procrastination. I hadn't graduated into pure thugdom yet, but I wasn't pursuing my potential either. The danger of procrastination is that we can get stuck in it for our entire lives. Even after we start our careers, we can get caught up in a cycle of choices that don't poison our lives but don't propel them either. Staying at a job that you don't care deeply about for 15 years reflects this sort of choice, as does staying in a romantic relationship where the spark has been gone for a long time. Those are choices. You can always find a new job if you're prepared to hustle and make sacrifices. You can always find new love if you're prepared to be fearless and take life as it comes. A lot of people choose not to make those choices. They'd rather wait for the chance they'll fulfill their destiny than actually choose to grab it. Our other choice is passion. One of the reasons I always refer to myself as a member of the Pinkett Smith Winfrey Knowles Carter family is because those are examples of five powerful Black people who have always picked their passion in life. Individuals who never let the circumstances of their situations dictate how they were going to live their lives. They never settled. They always went for what mattered to them. Those are the people I strive to emulate. When I was young, my passion was learning. I felt energized and fulfilled when I was reading a book or addressing a class. Then I got disconnected from my passion. My life and the lives of the people around me suffered greatly because of it. It wouldn't be until I weaned myself off the poison that was drug dealing and street life once and for all that I would be able to recognize the passion that would refocus and transform my life, the radio. Principle 3, fuck your dreams. The truth might hurt, but it's always helpful. Nobody wants to hear they're fat as fuck and need to lose weight, or they're not as talented at something as they think they are. But just because they're lying to themselves doesn't mean that you have to lie too. It doesn't benefit you or the person you're talking to when you sugarcoat your words. You have to tell people what they need to hear, as opposed to what they want to hear. And if you were the person getting that harsh dose of reality, then make sure you accept it. By the time I was 18, I'd already racked up quite the thug's resume. Multiple trips to summer school, expulsions from two high schools, and three arrests. In the movies, any one of those situations could have been the one that finally got me scared straight. But like I said earlier, this isn't the movies. This is real life. And in real life, the most important changes often don't happen overnight. They take place slowly. Not over the course of scenes, but over the course of months, sometimes even years. Ironically, it would be my cousins, the very guys who pulled me into the thug life, who would slowly inspire me to get out of it. Not because they were setting a better example themselves. Instead, over time, I became so disgusted with their decline that I became determined not to end up like them myself. In particular, watching my cousin Lamar fall off affected me deeply. When I was 14 or 15, Lamar seemed like the coolest dude in town. He was a talented barber, and people from all over Berkeley County would flock to our hood just to have him cut their hair. Through his barber business and selling a little dope on the side, Lamar always had money in his pocket and a beautiful woman by his side. If that wasn't enough, he could also dance and dress his ass off. I'll never forget going to visit him in Myrtle Beach, where he and his girl Jayla were staying at a fancy hotel with an ocean view called the Captain's Quarters. Jayla had a beautiful face, fat ass, big boobs, the type of woman a horny teenager like myself could only dream of. Man, all I want to do when I'm older is stay in a room like this with a girl like that, I told myself. That scene at the Captain's Quarters came to represent the epitome of success to me. A few years later, when I started making a little money, one of the first things I did was book a room there with Mook Mook. Unfortunately, by the time I'd graduated to the Captain's Quarters, Lamar had broken law number 4 of Biggie's 10 Crack Commandments. Never get high on your own supply. Once Lamar started hitting the pipe, his world fell apart quickly. Soon, the barber, who would never have dreamed of stepping outside without a fresh lineup, was letting his hair woof. The guy who always dressed fly was wearing the same sweatpants and t-shirts for days at a time. Folks stopped coming for haircuts, and Jayla left him, as did all the other girls he was messing with. He was only in his early 20s, but it was already clear to me that his life was never going to amount to anything. I saw something similar happen to my cousin Malik. He'd always been fly, respected by the guys and popular with the ladies. Then he started smoking crack, too. Soon he was another basshead wandering around with his dreads unkempt, his clothes a mess, and asking people if he could borrow $5. My cousin Anthony was yet another walking warning. To be fair, Anthony had the deck stacked against him because his father was a crackhead. Despite that, his grandmother and mother worked very hard trying to raise him right. He was a good football player in high school who also had a reputation of being a bit of a pretty boy. He always seemed to have a nice ride and a good-looking girlfriend. Anthony didn't go to college, but after high school, he got a solid job fixing air conditioners that kept good and legal money in his pocket. Over time, unfortunately, it became clear that Anthony liked to drink and smoke weed a little too much. Okay, way too much. It didn't help that Anthony was an angry drunk who would get into fights after a couple drinks. To make matters worse, he lost most of his teeth after he crashed his ATV four-wheeler, which of course he was riding drunk. Today he's in his 30s and is a mess. His teeth are mostly gone and his beard is completely gray. He looks like he's 50, yet he still keeps on drinking and smoking like he did when he was 18. When I think of drunk under a tree, I think of Anthony. Watching my cousins fall apart in front of my eyes terrified me. As badly as I wanted to be like them when I was younger, by the time I was 18 and 19, I didn't want to be like them just as badly. Even worse, the rest of my family was starting to view me with the same sort of disgust with which I had come to view Anthony, Malik, and Lamar. I learned that the summer I turned 18, when my Aunt Mutter announced that she was going to visit our family in Jersey. "Cool, I'm going to come too," I volunteered. It never occurred to me she'd have an issue with that, but she shot it down quick, telling me, "I'm sorry, baby, but I want no problems with no drugs and nothing." She was right to say that, but it truly hurt my feelings and made me think, dang, that's how y'all look at me? Another time I was bragging about this girl I was trying to talk to, one of the Valley girls from Stratford. Dana, one of my favorite cousins, overheard me and let me have it. "You really think a girl like that is going to want to be with somebody like you?" she asked with a snort, before adding, "Nah, you're exactly what TLC be talking about in that song. A scrub. You're on a fast track to nowhere. Why would she even mess with you?" Dana called me a scrub with complete conviction, too. Hearing that from someone in my family, especially a cousin I was close with, was like a smack in the face, one I desperately needed. In addition to being disgusted by watching my cousins go from ballers to bums, there were two particular incidents that helped me finally come to the realization that I didn't want to live a criminal lifestyle anymore. The first incident was after I'd begun buying my coke from this crazy dude named Clarence. One of the major problems with dealing drugs, outside of the obvious legal and ethical issues, is that it makes you extremely paranoid. Everything is lovely when the money first starts coming in, but after a few months, you start to become secretive, distrustful, and greedy. And that's only if you're not dipping into your own stash. Once you start doing that, there's no coming back. I never did coke or crack myself, but I was smoking way too much weed, which only heightened my paranoia. The first way it affected me was that it made me decide I needed my own coke source. I was so paranoid, I didn't want to share dealers with anyone else I knew. So I got down with Crazy Clarence. At first, he was great, always having a package ready to go whenever I needed to re-up, but it also became clear he could be reckless and impulsive. One time, I was back in my mom's house when Clarence and some other dudes showed up at 7 a.m. looking for some money I owed. And in case I didn't get the message that they wanted to get paid, they brought a couple guns with them to drive the point home. Not the kind of drama I should be bringing to my mother's house. I managed to talk Clarence down, but it was a tense scene. My father happened to be there, and as soon as Clarence and his crew left, he asked, "What the fuck did those boys want?" I tried to tell him they were looking for some video games they'd left with me, but my pops was too street savvy to fall for that. "Bullshit," he said. "No one is coming for video games at 7 in the morning. Whatever it is, those boys are going to blow your fucking brains out if you're not careful." A few weeks later, I found myself in an even worse situation with Clarence. As hard as it might be to believe, it can get much worse than an armed drug dealer showing up at your mother's door early in the morning. Once again, I found myself owing Clarence money, and once again, he wanted me to pay up. Only this time, he wanted me to go on a little drive with him to settle our debt. I didn't really have a choice, so I met Clarence at the appointed time and jumped in his ride. "Where we going?" I asked as he pulled off. "To rob this nigga crib that owe me some bread," Clarence replied matter-of-factly. "Hit this blunt," he added, passing me some weed. My heart sank. The last thing I wanted to be doing was breaking into what I was sure was another drug dealer's home with Clarence. How did we know the dealer wasn't going to be home? Was I going to get shot the moment I walked in the door? Were the police going to catch us on the way out? As we smoked, I became more and more paranoid. I had to think of a way out of the situation. "You ever do something like this before?" Clarence asked, taking another drag of the weed. "Yep," I lied, trying to sound as calm as possible. "I ran into some niggas' cribs one time, but no one was home." I wanted to dampen Clarence's enthusiasm for our mission. "It turned out to be a big waste of time," I continued. "When we got in there, we found it safe, but it was empty. Usually the niggas who you would think have mad money actually don't have anything in there. They usually keep it somewhere else." Yeah, you're probably right, Clarence said. We arrived at the house. Now listen, Clarence instructed me. I'm going to park. Then we walk up to the front door and kick it down. We're going to get dude down on the floor and then get the money. Fuck that, I thought to myself. I had to talk him out of this plan. Look, there's a light on, I said, pointing at the house. That means he's home. Suppose he's in there with some other dudes and they got guns. They might shoot us when we come through the door. Clarence evidently hadn't considered that scenario. Yeah, that's true, he said. Let me drive around the block a few times and feel it out. At least I bought myself a couple minutes. As we pulled around the corner, I saw the headlights of a car approaching from the other direction. Yo, that's the cops, I yelled. Though truthfully, I couldn't tell what sort of car it was. When Clarence heard that, he began to hit the gas, but I told him to slow down. If you speed, they'll get suspicious and pull us over, I told him. Just be cool, and they won't suspect nothing. Good call, Clarence told me, taking his foot off the gas. Man, fuck this. Let's do this another night. Word, I said calmly, though inside my mind, I was screaming, woo! I'd managed to outfox Clarence, but I didn't ever want to find myself in a spot like that again. The lifestyle was getting very old fast. In those days, I used to keep my crack in plastic tubes I'd buy at a fishing tackle store. They were meant to hold bait, but I realized they were perfect for drugs because they were airtight and waterproof. That way, I could throw them in the bushes or even toss them in the water if I thought the cops were coming. The guys in that bait and tackle shop must have thought I was one serious fisherman for all those tubes that I bought. One day, when I was at Jarrell's house, I somehow got it in my head that the cops were about to raid his place. Post-traumatic stress disorder is real. Hopefully you haven't experienced it, but being the subject of a drug raid is like being attacked by an army. I was paranoid for a long time after that. So I took a half ounce I was playing in the cell and hid it in his backyard. That night, I came back to Jarrell's to hang out with him and his cousin Vincent. Vincent was a real character. For starters, he was mentally challenged. He literally rode the short bus. But to make up for what he lacked in brain power, God had blessed Vincent with one of the biggest dicks in the entire universe. Seriously, this kid was the size of a Pringles can. How did I know that? Vincent was an unapologetic exhibitionist. It's a crime he never got into porn. Vincent would whip that thing out any chance he got and then chase people around singing, I'ma fuck your girl, yo. He particularly loved tormenting Anthony. Crackhead, son, I'ma fuck your girl. He'd sing out to Anthony, swinging his giant dick in two hands. The night in question, Jarrell, Vincent, and I were drinking and smoking and got pretty wasted. My paranoia softened by the booze, I decided it was finally safe to go retrieve my dope. But when I went to the spot I thought I'd left it at, I couldn't find it. I even got down on my hands and knees to search, but the crack was nowhere to be found. My paranoia came roaring back. How could it be missing? Had someone already taken it? That must be it. I decided that someone was probably Vincent. He was my guy, but he had been there when I stashed it earlier. He must have come back during the day when no one was looking to grab it. That crazy big dick bastard, I fumed. I can't believe he did me like that. I was frantic. How should I confront Vincent? Should I just yoke him up and demand to know where the dope was? Should I tell Jarrell and then the two of us could jump him? Or maybe Jarrell was in on it. Maybe they were both playing me. As my paranoia hit a fever pitch, I had a revelation. Something was seriously wrong with me. Only someone who had completely lost his way would be drunkenly crawling around in the dark looking for crack while convincing himself that he'd been outsmarted by an autistic kid with a porno-sized penis. I felt like I'd hit rock bottom. This is ridiculous, I thought to myself. I'm acting insane. I'm questioning my brothers who I know have my back. This drug world is too cutthroat. I don't want this to be my life anymore. I let the whole thing go and returned to drinking with Jarrell and Vincent. I never did find the dope, but that pathetic scene did start to wake me up to how out of control my life had become. The other turning point happened a few years later when I had already started to get into radio. Even though I was finally pursuing my passion, I was also still hanging around with my street dudes. I wanted to have it both ways, but the universe was about to let me know that wasn't an option. I learned that once and for all on June 8th, 2001. I decided to throw a party to celebrate my cousin Kente Palmer getting a football scholarship to Penn State. I rented a cabin at a place called Short Stay on nearby Lake Moultrie and invited a whole gang of people to come over and party. The night started off great. Lots of drinking, smoking, dancing, and bullshitting. But at some point, one of the girls passed out, and when she woke up later that night, she claimed that some of the dudes at the party had sexually assaulted her. I wasn't there at the time. I'd left to go get some weed, and when I finally heard about what had happened, the entire party had cleared out. Apparently, she'd gone into a dark room with some guys to have sex, and when she started to protest, one of them said, "Relax, it's Charlemagne." After I heard that rumor, I asked my homeboys who had been there, did anyone touch this girl sexually? Did someone use my name? They all swore to me up and down that nothing had happened. Early the next morning, my phone rang, and I expected it to be about the fallout from the party. Instead, it was my friend Booby who delivered the chilling message, "Yo, Scrap is dead." Scrap was Jarrell's cousin, someone I considered a big brother. Turns out he had died after driving home from a club drunk, hitting some railroad tracks at a high speed and flipping his car over. I couldn't process the information. I needed to get out of the house and talk to someone. So I headed over to Kitfield where my cousins always hung out. When I got there, sure enough, they were literally sitting under a tree. I jumped out of the car and started yelling, "Yo, Scrap is dead. He's dead." My cousins just looked at me and said, "Yeah, Kente is in jail too." "What?" I asked. "What's he in jail for?" "Man, you didn't hear? They said he raped a girl at that party last night." When I heard that, I was doubly devastated. Kente was about to go to Penn State, one of the most powerful football programs in the country. He had a chance of ending up in the NFL if things broke his way. I knew he hadn't been involved, but just the accusation alone could derail his dreams before they'd even begun. I hopped back in my car and drove straight to the police station to help clear Kente's name. When I got there, I told the officer at the desk that the whole party had been my idea. I rented the cabin. I bought the alcohol. I went out to get weed. I invited the girls. That was all my doing, I told her. I take full responsibility. Kente didn't set any of that up, and I know he didn't touch that girl. The officer listened to my confession, took a statement, and then said, "Okay, well, thank you for coming down here and sharing that. I'll let you know if we need anything else from you." Before I left, though, the cop hit me with a surprise. Kente hadn't been arrested for anything. Turned out my cousins had made the whole story up just to mess with me because they hadn't been invited to the party. I'd like to say I was shocked they'd do that, but I could believe it all too well. My older cousins had always hated on Kente and myself because we were younger and going places. Rather than cheer us on, they got more satisfaction out of trying to trip us up. The police did come and arrest me a few weeks later in connection to the assault. They took a couple of blood and hair samples, but released me the same day. Eventually, the criminal sexual charges were dropped, but I was hit with a charge of contributing to the delinquency of a minor because I'd bought the alcohol to the party. The previous stints in jail hadn't affected me, but that one, as brief as it was, definitely did. Deeply. As crazy as it may sound, forget about shooting at people, forget about drugs, this was a possible rape charge. That caught my attention. It was all too much. I had people possibly lying to girls, using my name to sexually assault women. I had people possibly stealing dope from me, not to mention forcing me to go on home invasions where God knows what might happen. Clearly, I needed some new friends. I'm done with this lifestyle, I told myself with finality. I'm done with all this street shit, the lies, the drama, the danger, the death. I'm not going to make it if I try to keep one foot in the street. It's going to suck me in, and I'm never going to get out. Yes, I'd said those words before. This time, I meant them. The witness dream. Like a lot of people who find themselves disillusioned with the street lifestyle, I thought religion might help me get into a better mental and spiritual space. Since I'd grown up a Jehovah's Witness, that congregation seemed like a logical place to look for a fresh start. I'd stopped going to Kingdom Hall, which is like the witness equivalent of church, when I was 13 or 14, but as my life started to spiral out of control, my mother and several of my aunts kept encouraging me to give it another try. I wanted to make them happy, but I was apprehensive. The truth is, despite being raised in it, I'd never felt a strong connection with the faith. And even with my love for books, I actively hated going to book study on Thursday nights because it meant I'd have to miss the Cosby Show in a different world. It sucked to go into school on Friday morning and everybody would be buzzing about what happened with Lisa Bonet the night before, but I didn't know what they were talking about. On very rare occasions, we'd get to stay home on a Thursday, and I can remember how incredibly excited I was just to be able to catch one of those shows. Plus, being a witness made me feel left out at school. If you're not familiar with the faith, witnesses also don't observe Christmas, Halloween, Father's Day, or any other holiday. Whenever there was a celebration in school, we couldn't be part of it. Most of the kids had no idea why we'd always be off to the side during Christmas plays or Halloween parades, or why we couldn't even make cards for Mother's Day or Father's Day. To my pop's credit, he understood the awkward position we were in. Every year, he'd make sure to pick up Christmas gifts for us, even if we weren't celebrating the holiday. I remember one year it was a Nintendo, another year it was a pair of high-tech boots, not the knockoffs I'd asked my mother to buy me at Payless, but the official high-techs that all the cool kids were rocking. I might not have gotten them on Christmas morning, but I got them. That was the first day all the kids came back from break and were bragging about whatever they'd gotten for Christmas. I could chime in with, oh yeah, I got that new Nintendo too, and not feel completely left out. My father understood moments like those can be important to a kid. That's why my biggest beef with the witnesses is that I didn't like how they treated my father. When he was struggling with drugs and really needed support, I felt like they turned their backs on him. One night, one of the brothers, similar to a deacon in a Baptist church, stood up and announced, Larry McKelvey is being disfellowshipped from the Kingdom Hall of Jehovah's Witnesses. After that, no one was allowed to talk to him while he was on the premises. The theory is that the shame of being isolated will motivate you to correct whatever mistakes you've made, but I thought the whole concept was whack. If someone is going through a rough period, help them. Don't ostracize them and make them feel even worse about themselves. Their methods weren't always as severe as defellowshipping someone. When I was particularly troubled as a teenager, some of the elders from the Kingdom Hall would come study with me at my mother's house. I remember I was studying with one of the elders and I asked him about Deuteronomy 14:8, which states, and the pig, because it parts the hoof but does not chew the cud, is unclean for you. Their flesh you shall not eat, and their carcasses you shall not touch. When I asked how come then we still ate pig, he replied, well, that's from the Old Testament. We think if you pray over the food, it's fine to eat. Being the smartass that I am, I said, well, the Bible also says you shouldn't have sex before marriage. So if I pray over the pussy, then I can fuck it, right? Sounded like a perfectly logical question to me, but I do remember him squeezing my hands extra tight when he prayed with me later on that night. Despite moments like that, I did return to the hall to both make my mother happy and to see if I could find some motivation to help me turn my life around. It took only a few services, however, before I decided that being a witness wasn't the answer for me. I respect that the faith has lent a lot of stability and support to my mother's life. I don't know if she would have made it through some of those rough times without the community having her back. It wasn't going to have the same impact on my life. I don't think there's any organized religion that is the answer for me. I've taken valuable lessons from many organized groups, the Witnesses, the Nation of Islam, the 5%ers, just to name a few. At the end of the day, however, I'm a spiritual person, not a religious one. Having said that, I do believe that in order to be truly successful in this world, you need to have a close relationship with God. I'm not telling you that you have to go out and convert to Islam, get baptized in the name of Christianity, or become a Jehovah's Witness, but you do have to have some type of spiritual foundation. I'm always shocked when I run into people who don't believe in God. I'll even ask them, how can you not believe that there's a power greater than you who's engineering this whole system of things? Usually they'll tell me something like, man, God is just some mystical fairy tale. God is no different than Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, or the Tooth Fairy. I disagree wholeheartedly, but that mindset is honestly one of the reasons I don't sell that junk about holiday headliners to my daughters. Maybe it's the witness influence on me, but to this day, I'm not a fan of holidays. I think it's a mistake to hype your kids on Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, and the Tooth Fairy on one hand, and then try to sell them on God with the other. When they get older and realize Santa and the Easter Bunny aren't real, it becomes too easy for them to dismiss God as well. So you were lying to me about everybody else, but this God character is real? They'll say, yeah, right. And then they'll miss out on the affirmation, confidence, and faith that religion can provide when they're older and really need it. True love, false dream. I might have been raised a witness, but my true religion was hip-hop. Hip-hop culture was where I found inspiration, direction, and community. Ever since my cousin Ty had put on that Rakim record, hip-hop had become the driving force in my life. When I was out in the streets, hip-hop is what helped me dream. When I was in jail, it was what helped me pass the time and stay positive. Hip-hop dictated every aspect of my lifestyle, what I wore, what I drove, what I ate, how I rapped to females and dealt with other males. Being so heavily involved in the culture, it was only natural I decided I wanted to be a rapper myself. Let's face it, almost every guy in the hood thinks he can be the next Jay-Z or Lil Wayne, especially if you have the gift of gab like I did. When you see guys who came from backgrounds like yours popping champagne on yachts, driving around in the flyest cars, and wearing expensive jewelry, it's easy to fall into the trap of thinking, hey, I can do that too. I didn't just fall into that trap, I dove into it head first. I started off like most kids do, just rhyming in the lunchroom or on front stoops with my friends, making up new lyrics to popular songs, especially after I smoked a little weed. Rapping was the way I wanted to express myself. My partner in rhyme was Jarrell. In many ways, our mutual love for hip-hop is what brought us together as friends. One of the first times I was ever over at his house, we were smoking weed, and some of the other dudes there were like, yo, Larry, kick something for us. I ran down whatever little rap I was working on at the time, and Jarrell liked it. From that point onward, we were always talking hip-hop together. A lot of people have a corny rap name buried deep in their closets, but few were cornier than mine. Dizzy Van Winkle. I use Dizzy because once one of my boys called me Dizzy Ass. I looked up the definition of Dizzy and saw that it meant mentally confused. For some reason, I liked that. The Van Winkle was a play on the idea of having been asleep for years and finally waking up. Stupid, I know. But when you're 17 years old and have smoked a couple blunts, it sort of makes sense. One of the earliest raps I wrote was inspired by the original version of Biggie's classic One More Chance. My not-so-classic rap went, "Girl, you got plenty more dicks to suck. I'm about to choke. I don't give a fuck. You gonna suck my dick until I nut. Plenty more balls to lick. Oh, shit. Suck it, girl, just like you're sucking on a mint. Plenty more salad to toss. Oh, yeah. Put that tongue between my cheeks like it's butt floss." What can I tell you? I was whack. Even though I'm a natural talker, it never fully translated to rapping. No matter what sort of beat I was rhyming over, classic boom, bap, up-tempo, slow, or dirty south bounce, I'd struggle to stay in the pocket. I practiced and practiced, but could never completely get in sync with the beat. Jarrell, on the other hand, could rap his ass off. He lived in the pocket. He always stayed on top of the beat, slipping in and out of the rhythm the way a great surfer rides a wave. After messing around for a few years, when we were about 17, Jarrell came to me and said, "Yo, let's actually do this. Let's go get a record deal." He didn't have to tell me twice. Being a rapper is what I've been dreaming of, too. To cement our commitment, I got a tattoo of Wolverine from the X-Men holding a microphone on my arm. Wolverine was one of my favorite X-Men characters, a natural loner who didn't mind being part of a team when needed. Wolverine also had healing powers, which I felt I possessed emotionally as well. I felt like I could bounce back quick from things. I felt like I was going to be Wolverine on the microphone. There weren't many opportunities for rappers in a place like Moss Corner, but there was a group of guys in the area who started a label called TNT Records. "I know these guys," my pops told me one time when I mentioned looking for a deal. "If you're really serious about this thing, I can introduce you to them." TNT was short for Tabby and Tyrone, and it turned out to be backed by the OG Calvin Washington. Of course I wanted to be down. So at my father's introduction, I went over to their studios in North Charleston. There was a gang of rappers milling around the studio looking to get signed, but Calvin went out of his way to show me more respect than the others. I hadn't done anything as an MC to earn that sort of respect, so I was surprised at the time, but I later came to understand it was my father's influence. Nothing popped off right away, but I kept in contact with TNT over the next few months, and it seemed like they were interested in signing me to a deal. Then one night, I went over to the studio, and as I started to pull into the parking lot, I saw FBI agents swarming all over that place. There were white dudes and dark windbreakers everywhere. I didn't even slow down. Just kept on driving and never looked back. Even though it never landed me a deal, hanging out at their studio led to one of the most important conversations of my life. During a session one night, I met a rapper named Willie Will, who was also an overnight jock at the local hip-hop radio station Z93 Jams. I had just graduated from night school and was looking for opportunities, so I asked him how he got put on at the station. "I just started with an internship," he told me. "How hard is it to get one?" I asked. "Oh, it ain't nothing," he replied. "Just go down there and tell them you want to intern. They'll have you fill out a couple of papers and probably give you something on the spot." I was a little skeptical about how interested a radio station would be in a recent night school graduate who'd already been arrested twice, but I didn't have anything to lose. So one day, Mook Mook drove me to the station, and it turned out Willie was right. I had a couple conversations, filled out a few forms, and bam, I was an intern at Z93 Jams. After interning at Jams for a few months, I noticed that the station had a good relationship with a local rap label named Never So Deep Records, which was making a lot of noise. It was run by a middle-aged guy named Dr. Robert Evans and his son Robert Jr., or DJ Bless, who was also the in-house producer. Even though the TNT situation hadn't worked out, I was still clinging to my dream of making it as a rapper. So I decided to go over to Never So Deep and introduce myself. I was a little wary because a local rapper I knew named Infinity the Ghetto Child had told me that he thought something about Dr. Evans and Bless's energy was off. Even though he was signed to their label, he didn't really like Dr. Evans and Bless. I was prepared not to like them too, but after meeting them in person, I had the exact opposite impression. Their studio had a real family vibe to me, and everyone treated me with respect and warmth. Plus, there was no denying that DJ Bless's tracks were absolute fire. Unfortunately, by the time I linked up with Never So Deep, Jarrell was too caught up in the streets to really focus on rapping. Ironically, Jarrell would return to rapping years later, and it would end up costing him his life. In 2013, he was recording in a studio in a mobile home when a gunman came looking for someone else. Jarrell was apparently in the vocal booth with his headphones on and didn't hear what was going on. The gunman sprayed up the place, and now my partner is dead. Rest in peace. Since Jarrell was distracted, Willie Will and I decided to form a group called the Street Lords. Dr. Evans and Bless were interested in working with us, so we recorded about 4 records with them. Willie and I were trash as rappers, but Bless's production was so great that it seemed like we might be able to make something happen despite our limitations. The more time I spent around Dr. Evans and Bless, I began to suspect that it wasn't their energy that Infinity didn't like, but their work ethic. They were disciplined in a way that I hadn't experienced before in a hip-hop setting. The studio cultivated a healthy professional environment because neither of the Evanses smoked or drank. In fact, I can remember being in the lobby drinking a Ballantine Ale, and Dr. Evans walked over and asked, "Yo, can you get that shit out of here for me?" That doesn't happen too often. In addition to no drinking, Dr. Evans also didn't allow any weed smoking or chasing girls. Guys like Infinity didn't appreciate that. They wanted to come to the studio, get high, spit their rhymes, and have a party. I never really met anyone like Dr. Evans before and wanted to learn more about him. I came to find out he was from Queens. He'd been an NYPD cop for over a decade before getting his medical license and then moving down to South Carolina to help his son run Never So Deep. They might have come down south to make music, but the scene at Never So Deep was about much more than beats and rhymes. Dr. Evans and Bless practiced V Honest Jitsu every day and even had a dojo in the back of the studio. Dr. Evans made us work out and watch what we ate. He was also a heavy reader and put me on the impactful books like The Art of War and taught me about historical figures I'd been sleeping on like Denmark Vesey. He preached that in order to reach our full potential, both our bodies and our minds needed to be sharp. Being around his positive, focused energy had me looking at life in a different way. He was becoming an incredible mentor to me, one who was about to give me the most important career advice I'd ever receive. Birth of the Radio Guy. I was interning in Jam's promotions department, but I didn't really care that much about learning the promo game. Instead, what had me excited was that the internship allowed me to hang out with Willie Will while he did his overnight shifts. Technically, I wasn't supposed to be sitting in during his shifts, but I wasn't going to let a small detail like the lack of permission slow me down. If I had waited for that invitation to come to the studio, I might still be waiting. I wanted to see what an overnight shift was like, so I just showed up and basically never left. Once I was in the room, I never tried to muscle my way onto the mic, but I made my presence felt. I cracked little jokes to keep Willie loose, cut out newspaper articles for him to talk about, pass him notes on funny things he could say about artists, and generally keep the energy upbeat. After a few months of playing the background, people began to notice I was having a positive impact on Willie's show. Ron White, who was the music director at the time, approached me at one of the station's outdoor events. "I hear you popping up now and then on Willie's show," he told me. "Would you be interested in having a spot on air yourself?" he asked me. "Hell yeah," I quickly replied. Ron was prepared to give me a shot, but I had to prove myself first. I started off doing voice tracking for Sunday mornings. That meant the station would record me hosting a show earlier in the week and then play it back on Sunday mornings, which was a slow shift since most people were either asleep or in church. I quickly passed the sounds good on the mic test, but I apparently failed the able to create appropriate content for a Sunday morning test. Ron moved me to Saturday nights, which fit me better. Once I cut my teeth doing that, I started filling in for Willie when he was traveling, or for other jocks when they couldn't make their shifts. It was an unexpected position to be in, but I had an advantage working in my favor. I didn't know radio. No one had taught me the right way to do anything. I didn't work in my college radio station. I hadn't even gone to college. I hadn't attended a technical institute that instructed me on how to work the boards or set up the mics. I was a blank slate. I literally walked off a dirt road and up into the station. The only thing I knew how to do was run my big-ass mouth. So that's what I did. I got in front of the mic and talked. I didn't know about liners or positioning statements or how to come in and out of commercial breaks. I just stated my opinions. "Yeah, that's the new Nelly song, E.I., I might say. Damn, that record is whack." I talked to my listeners the way I talked to my friends. It might not have been the most sophisticated approach, but it worked. From almost the first shift I hosted, people would let me know they liked how I sounded. In particular, I remember getting a call from Tessa Spencer, who at the time was the co-host of the Big Morning Show in Charleston, ironically also called The Breakfast Club. They were local celebrities, hosting parties and appearing on TV commercials. "You sound great on air," Tessa told me, "like you've done this before." To me, Tessa represented the pinnacle of success. To hear her say I sounded good was a tremendous confidence boost. Being on air gave me a sense of freedom that I'd never experienced before. Some folks clam up or get nervous when it's time to go live, but I got a rush from knowing I could connect with thousands of people. I loved that I could make someone out there laugh or get pissed off. Just knowing that I was connecting was an incredible experience. For years, I'd been looking for that sense of belonging, and in radio, I had finally found it. But even though the rest of the world could see me growing into my gift, I was still focused on getting a deal for my rap groups. I'd become very inspired by how Ludacris came up. For those of you who don't know, he was a rapper who'd gotten a deal thanks in large part to his success as a radio DJ. I made the mistake of thinking Luda's path was the same one that I had to follow. The person who finally helped me clear off my lenses and see my future clearly was Dr. Evans. As soon as I'd gotten on air, he recognized that I'd found my actual calling. He started schooling me on great African-American DJs like Petey Green in D.C. and Frankie Crocker in New York City. Guys who didn't just play records, but had made their reputation off their wit and opinions. He told me I possessed some of the same talent he'd heard in them. I appreciated the compliments, but I believe my future still lay in being a rapper. One day he finally pulled me aside and said, "Listen, Charlamagne, I know your dream is to be a famous rapper, but fuck that dream. You're just not that good. You are, however, great at being a radio jock," he continued. "Focus on that instead. And if you still want to be involved in hip-hop, learn the behind-the-scenes skills of running a label, because it's never going to happen for you as a rapper. You need to dead that dream." When Dr. Evans told me that, it was as if a giant weight had been lifted off my shoulders. As I've said, deep down, I never felt comfortable rapping. Every time I went into the studio to spit a verse, I'd get a little tight and anxious. I'd overthink instead of just being natural. I'd try to be hard instead of just being myself. The exact opposite of how I felt talking on the radio. That's why I didn't put up a fight with Dr. Evans when he dashed my dream. I didn't get offended and say, "Are you crazy? That last Dizzy Van Winkle verse was fire." Rather, I calmly replied, "You're right. I'm done." Simple as that. I was through with rapping and ready to dedicate my talents to the radio. Fuck your dream if it's not really yours. I'm incredibly grateful that in Dr. Evans, I had a mentor who was honest enough to tell me, "Fuck your dream." It sounds strange, thanking someone for announcing you suck, but it's the type of mentorship that's desperately needed, especially in the African-American community. Everybody wants to be successful in life. That's the goal, whether you're Black, white, Spanish, Asian, or Martian. Still, a young Black person growing up in America is going to have a slightly more narrow view on how to obtain that success. That's because when we see examples of success that look like us, they are usually in sports and entertainment. It's no surprise that growing up, everybody wanted to be the next Jay-Z, the next Oprah, or the next Michael Jordan. Just as now, people want to be the next Drake, the next Issa Rae, or the next Steph Curry. Don't get me wrong, those are tremendous people to emulate. But the problem is, most people simply aren't born with the specific talents necessary to excel in those fields. You might have been born with a gene that makes you predisposed to be able to build a stem cell or design a skyscraper. But you'll never realize that if you waste your time trying to spit rhymes like Jay-Z or shoot threes like Steph. Jay himself said, "Remind yourself, nobody built like you, you designed yourself." That should be our collective mentality. Design yourself, construct your own dream. We have to stop thinking that just because we see something working spectacularly for someone else, that's the only path available to us. I was lucky because my father never pushed me to follow the same dreams as everyone else. My cousins were getting football scholarships to places like Clemson, Penn State, and Alabama. But my father helped me look beyond sports. He might say, "You need to get in the weight room and get a little buff just so I'd be able to handle myself." But he never made me feel that the football field was my only chance to make it. Think about being a doctor, a lawyer, or an engineer, he'd encourage me. Just as my mother was always pushing me to read books that would make me think about worlds and lifestyles that I wouldn't otherwise encounter in my day-to-day life. Even with that sort of constant encouragement, I still gravitated to one of the stereotypical dreams for kids in my community, rapping. Thankfully, Dr. Evans woke me up, but not enough young people have a presence like that in their lives. Instead, they spend years and years chasing their dream of being a rapper, even though the world keeps telling them it's not for them. It really breaks my heart to think of all the people who could have been great engineers, architects, doctors, and lawyers, but never even considered those dreams, let alone chased them, all because the entertainment game looked so glamorous. The demotivational speaker. In response to this epidemic of false dream chasing in the African-American community, I try to use my voice and platform to be what I call a demotivational speaker. Ever since I first got on the radio, I've been approached by a steady stream of people who are looking for help in breaking into the entertainment industry. They might send me a link to their mixtape or ask me to listen to their podcast or check out their new song. For a long time, I'd make an honest effort to listen, but I'd rarely hear anything that would capture my attention. A few years ago, I decided that I was finished being fake in those situations. First, being fake just goes against my basic nature. Second, I wasn't doing these people any favors by passively encouraging them to waste their time. Taking a page from Dr. Evans, I vowed that if I saw a person following someone else's dream, I'd let them know. What they did with that information was their call, but I'd at least be candid with them. One example, a couple years ago, I was asked to host a talent show at Penn State. Before the show even started, I knew what I was going to see, a lot of rappers. We were at an institution of higher learning filled with state-of-the-art facilities and brilliant professors, but I knew I was going to be asked to judge a lot of students chasing the same dream my cousins and I chased back on the dirt roads in Mount's Corner. So before the performance started, I addressed the crowd. I want to make one thing clear. I am a demotivational speaker. My job tonight is to get all you students on your proper career path. You guys already have a great plan, which is being at one of the best universities in the country. You guys are majoring in all these amazing fields like agriculture, engineering, criminal justice, and economics. Yet some of you still have pipe dreams of being a rapper. And I'm here to tell you, fuck your dreams. So if anyone gets up on this stage tonight and is anything less than the next Jay-Z or Nicki Minaj, please boo the shit out of them. Please hurt their feelings. Please make them feel so bad that they'll never think of wasting their time on rapping again and will head right back to the library where they belong. Maybe then they can find a cure for AIDS or figure out a new way to grow crops like they're supposed to instead of wasting their talents on this played-out dream. The crowd laughed, but I was dead serious. Sure enough, one of the first performers up was a wannabe rapper. He had long dreads, wore fatigues, and smelled like weed as he walked past me. "This guy ain't a rapper," I announced. "He gotta be y'all's weed man." The crowd went wild. Evidently, I nailed it. He shot me a dirty look and then proceeded to spit a terrible rhyme. I let him finish and then decided it was time to dead his misplaced dream. I started by going in on his appearance. "Nigga out here looking like one version of 10 different rappers," I told him as the crowd howled. "Nigga look like 2 Chainz, Ace Hood, Cash Out, fuck out of here." The guy immediately rushed back on stage and started shouting at me like he wanted to fight before security hustled him off. "See, this is why nobody likes rappers," I said. "That's why rappers can't make it in life." I later found out the reason he wanted to fight was because he felt I was snitching on him with the weed man comment. He was, in fact, one of the campus weed dealers and had already caught a charge. The kid was clearly delusional. I'd never even met him before and simply made a general observation based on his appearance. If anything, he'd snitched on himself by overreacting to the comment. Yes, I was rough on the kid, but he needed it. Hopefully, he went back to his dorm after the show and reconsidered how he was spending his college career. If he thought, "Man, maybe this rapping thing isn't for me after all," then I did my job. Because he was terrible. Some kids on campus might have told him he was nice, but they probably just wanted free weed. There was no scenario where that guy was ever getting a record deal. He had, however, demonstrated a hustler's mentality. Maybe he could apply some of his entrepreneurial instinct to an internship on Wall Street or a sales job in the advertising world. And to be clear, I don't just go around discouraging college students. No. I offer my demotivational speaking services free of charge to anyone I see chasing the wrong dream. Take Music Soulchild, an incredibly gifted R&B singer who has made some classic joints like Love, which I used to rock my daughter to sleep to. But despite his undeniable talent, Music never quite reached the level of commercial success he deserves. A few years ago, he decided that the way for him to finally break through was to reinvent himself as a rapper named The Hustle. It was a terrible idea. One that didn't reflect Music's true dream of being a classic R&B singer. "I can't respect The Hustle," I began the interview when he came on The Breakfast Club. "Music Soulchild is a great R&B singer. Why conform to what these kids are doing today?" Music responded that he wanted to be a rapper because he was bored of singing. I wasn't buying it. We argued back and forth about the validity of the project, with Music finally conceding that the concept was rooted in his desire to make more money. To me, that confirmed my suspicion. He wasn't chasing his dream. He was chasing the money. So it was time to properly demotivate him. "You're an amazing artist," I reminded him. "That's why I don't like seeing you conform to such a gimmick." "It might not be for you," Music shot back. "I don't think it is, dog," I replied. "I don't think it's for you either. I don't want you to feel like you're not appreciated as Music Soulchild, because you are appreciated." Music and I eventually agreed to disagree on Hustle, but it seems the public was on my side. I never heard any talk about that album. To me, that's the universe letting music know he was chasing a false dream and should have stuck to his true calling, which is making beautiful, stirring love songs. If he releases another album filled with songs like that, I'll be the first to pick it up. Sometimes you have the right dream but the wrong approach. If that's the case, then you still need a demotivational speech. I had to give one to T-Pain when he came on a show I was hosting in Columbia, South Carolina. T-Pain was promoting his debut single, I'm Sprung, which featured him using the auto-tune program he ended up making infamous. Back then, auto-tune was only something I knew from my pops, Roger Troutman records. So I was curious about why T-Pain was using it. I asked him to sing the song live without any auto-tune, and to his credit, he accepted my challenge. Unfortunately, he sounded like trash. Instead of trying to play it off, or even worse, tell him he sounded good, I kept him 100. That was terrible, I told him. You really need to work on improving your voice. T-Pain didn't appreciate my honesty. He even called me a few days later to cuss me out. Stop playing that clip, he told me after it went viral. You're fucking with my money. But I held my ground. Sorry, man, I told him. It's for your own good. You got to learn how to sing for real. Thankfully, T-Pain took my advice to heart. A couple years later, he appeared on the Wendy Williams show and said that my demotivational speech is what inspired him to stop relying on auto-tune and start focusing on his art. I want to thank Charlamagne, he said. If it wasn't for him, I wouldn't be in the position I am now. He made me take my craft seriously. I stopped smoking and really started working on my vocal technique. I was happy to help. Today, T-Pain and I are good friends and are even working together on several TV projects. The T-Pain example is critical because there are going to be people who tell you fuck your dreams when in fact you are on the right path, when you have found your actual gift. I had a moment like that once with my cousin aunt. The only reason I call her a cousin aunt was because she was like my parents' cousin, but she was actually my cousin's aunt. So I would call her Aunt Penny, like my cousins did, even though she was actually closer to a cousin to me. Make sense? Of course it doesn't. So let's just say Aunt Penny. Anyway, I remember being in her kitchen with all my younger cousins around the time I was doing overnights at jams. I was drunk and pontificating about my life plans, about how I was going to be as big as Tom Joyner, Doug Banks, Angie Martinez, Big Tigger, or any of the radio personalities who were popping at the time. Yes, I was running my mouth, but I was also trying to speak my success into fruition. Aunt Penny heard me from the other room and stuck her head into the kitchen to add her 2 cents. Larry, you shouldn't put your goals so high, because when you don't achieve them, you'll be disappointed. I literally heard a record scratch when she said that. I took a moment, then looked at my cousin aunt and declared, that's the dumbest shit I ever heard in my life. I almost always show respect for my elders, but that comment had me hot. Don't dream too big is a very poisonous thought to put into the mind of a young person. If you look at her own kids today or her nephews and nieces, none of them are doing much with their lives, probably because they listen to her advice. This is why it's critical that you be able to tell the difference between someone telling you fuck your dreams in order to get you on the right path or simply telling you fuck your dreams because they've already given up on their own. I trusted Dr. Evans because I knew he had taken the time to observe me to see what I was capable of. Plus, he was an accomplished individual in his own right. He was someone who strove to get the most out of life, someone who chose pursuing passion over procrastination. Those are the types of people you want to listen to. The key is to remember that no matter who you are or where you come from, your dream